Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Well, 16-year-old Angela was hesitating. Why don't we have the club meet at the library on Friday?
Oh, you know how quiet you have to be in there, Greg reminded her. Why don't we meet at someone's house?
Great idea, Darla chimed in. After all, it'll be Friday after school anyway. We could just relax, kick back, really get our whole program figured out.
Can't go to my house, Tom apologized. My dad's recuperating from surgery. He doesn't want anyone around right now.
My mom doesn't get home till 6, but she'd be really ticked if a bunch of people were hanging out all over the place when she came home, remarked Susie.
We won't make a mess, Greg interjected, and then added, maybe we should go to a house closest to school.
That leaves me out, said Paula. I'm on the last stop of the bus route.
Well, I just get off before you, Greg reminded her.
Hey, Angela, Tom spoke up. Why don't we meet at your house?
Yeah, echoed Greg.
That's the best idea, Susie chimed in. Well, Angela began. I don't exactly live at home. It's not like a home. It's sort of a motel.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about homeless children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest works with children and families in just such circumstances. Dr. Roxanne Dryden-Edwards, a child and adolescent psychiatrist, is medical director of the National Center for Children and Families. She's also the author of a book, Infertility from Both Sides of the Stethoscope, a guide from a doctor who's been there. And she's the mother of a young son. We're so glad you can be with us, Dr. Dryden-Edwards.
Thank you for having me.
What's the biggest worry that homeless children are likely to have?
And I think the biggest worry that they go through is uncertainty. I mean, there are things that most children are able to count on, the biggest probably being a place to live, a place to come home to every day after school or daycare. And homeless children don't have that. Along with that, they find themselves, you know, in a homeless situation because they're poor, most likely, or had some sort of financial challenge, or they would be able to afford housing. So they often also go through uncertainty about where's my next meal going to come from? Am I going to be in the same place today as I was last night? Am I going to be able to go to the same school as I did last week?
So the one thing that adults need to be tuned into is a need for some sort of basic comfort to these kids because they must be very on edge all the time.
Absolutely. Stability, comfort, certainty. I tend to think and teach in examples, and I think about, I was talking to a teenager I worked with last week who was saying how angry she is and irritable she is and seems to be at school, and she said, because I feel like I'm so behind. It's now, you know, whatever time of the year that she got dropped into her current school, and she has to figure out how to achieve, and that's very difficult. You know, I always imagine what would it be like for us to be plopped into a different job and then get plopped into another one in a couple of months and the learning curve we all go through. So absolutely, the uncertainty, I think, is really key and traumatic.
How do the children do in school with those kinds of situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, all the research really shows that children tend to have great difficulty when they're homeless, and they try to hone in on why that is. Is it because they had some problem coming into it that caused it? Is it because of the transitions? What's the reason? And most of the research indicates that it's really the uncertainty. It's the change. Again, you know, thinking in examples and being able to put ourselves in their shoes, so to speak, we can all understand what it would be like to have to change your jobs every 2 or 3 months. It would be really impossible. And so that's a little bit of what they go through.
What's the most important thing that you think caring adults can do for these kids?
I really think the most important thing is get involved. It can feel overwhelming at times. If you understand the statistics on homelessness and how prevalent it is and how many children go through this, it can be daunting. The feeling can be daunting. However, each one do one. If you do anything, you don't have to feel like you have to quit your current job and dedicate your life to the homeless. You can do something as small but significant as donating your old clothes and furniture and housewares. You can volunteer to mentor, to tutor, even if it's once. That's more than a child might have had ever. There's many, many things people can do to get involved. You can keep your ear to the ground. Listen to what your children are saying. If there's a child in your child's class that may be homeless, you might check in with that child. Oftentimes, just a kind word can make a big difference.
How is the school setting different for homeless kids, aside from this fact that they're constantly in different school settings, mm-hmm. or maybe periodically? How does being in school differ for them?
Well, I think you really hit on it when you use the word differ. Every child wants to be like other kids. They want to fit in. It's key. I mean, we feel it as adults, but it's acute for children. And so I think the way that it's mostly different for them is they're trying so hard to fit in, just like all children are, but they have clearly less resources to do so. It may be a matter of just the clothes they wear, the lunches they bring or don't bring, the school bus. You'd be surprised. They're ashamed to be seen coming off the cheese bus. They call it the cheese bus in this country, in the United States. Why are you getting off a funny-looking bus? Why aren't you walking? Why do you get a school lunch from the cafeteria? Why do you use tickets instead of money? Why don't you bring a lunch? These are all things that we adults, understandably, don't think about every day, but are acutely painful for homeless children.
So their self-esteem is really battered almost on a daily basis, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And that's another really excellent point, because everybody wants to be good at something. It really needs to be good at something. And what I found in my work is if a child or an adult feels like I don't have a chance at being good at anything good, then I'll be good at doing something bad. I have to be good at something. I'd rather be, and the other axiom that comes up is every child, every human being really, would rather be seen as a bad person than a disadvantaged, poor, quote-unquote stupid kid. So to mask, for example, the fact that I didn't get to learn my ABCs, for example, yet because I was busy moving 3 and 4 times, I'll just pretend that I'm a bad kid. And then you won't ask me the ABCs because I'll be busy going to the principal's office. Mm. And none of this is conscious. They're not planning this out, but that's what's at the root of it.
Do you think that we equate poverty with stupidity?
It can. Absolutely. I think you're right. I'm not slamming our society. Certainly, I'm as good a capitalist as anybody else. But that's one of the potential downsides of a capitalist society, where it's a matter of what can you achieve? What can you produce? And if you feel like you come to the table with less product than other people, you don't have a house, consistent food, consistent clothing, fashionable new clothing, then that's what you're labeled. A great example is there's a famous surgeon at Johns Hopkins, where I used to work, Dr. Benjamin Carson. He was not homeless. I'm not putting that out there. But he started out with some troubles. And he's the chief of neurosurgery and a brilliant, brilliant man who could have gone down a very, very different path. So I think that's a very good example of how you can get labeled and stay with the label. And it's really more human nature to stay with however we're seen than to depart from it. He was very lucky, had a great mom, and he was very skilled. But that's the exception, not the rule, I think.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on homeless families and children.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Roxanne Dryden-Edwards about homeless families. How do homeless children usually interact with their peers? We touched on this a little bit, but this must be a big issue.
It certainly is. You know, a lot of energy that most of us are able to spend or to dedicate to learning in school, they have to plan out to figure out how to keep their secret, if that's what they decide to do, how to scan their environment, figure out who's not going to humiliate me, who's not going to ostracize me. That's a lot of work that's going on up in their head, and that's space that geometry can't take up because they're busy trying to fit in, where most kids don't have to do that work. They already fit in.
Do you think that means that these kids have a little bit better radar?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. They're amazing survivors, and you hit on a strength. I don't mean at all to portray homeless children as nothing redeeming, and there's no strength they have. They, you know, what they lack in resources, they absolutely make up for in survival skills. And so some of the work that we do is trying to just hone those survival skills and direct it towards achieving things and, you know, being able to fit in to society rather than going the other way.
We talked about peers a little bit, but what about parents of their peers?
Mm-hmm.
What can grown-ups do if they notice that there is probably a child in the class who is homeless?
Mm-hmm. I think grown-ups, parents of children who are not homeless can be a great and amazing resource to children who are and to families who are. And you don't have to feel like you're intruding. It can, again, be as simple as speaking kind words to the child, making sure that they're included in things. Even if it's something that may cost money, you might quietly pay for their spot. And if the parent who's homeless asks you about it, just it's free. It can be many things. It can be listening to your child and hearing, you know, what's going on with all their friends. You don't necessarily need to focus and put the spotlight on the homeless child too much, because that can be ostracizing. But if you just kind of keep your ear to the ground for the homeless child, it can be important. And I think another thing that can make a difference forever as a parent is teaching your child to be sensitive, to understand that everybody doesn't have it like us, and that those people aren't bad because of it. They're unfortunate, and there but for the grace of whoever our higher power is, go we.
So how do we do that? How can peers learn to be more sensitive to a homeless classmate's needs?
You know, you can do it every single day in everything you do, or you can do it in one piece of whatever you do. Anytime you hear about a drive at school, if you're into a place of worship, in a community center, whatever, you can keep your ear to the ground about contributing to that, involving your child in that. For example, my son helps pack up stuff, takes his little change and shares it and puts it in a box that goes to the charitable organization. They're really never too young. Once they can talk, they can learn in a verbal way in terms of how you want to help people that aren't as lucky as you are, and educating them, just talking about it. Saying, you know what? I thought I'd never hear myself say this, but, you know, when he doesn't want to eat his peas, everybody don't have peas. Okay? We're lucky to have peas.
About Armenia when we were growing up. I thought everyone in Armenia didn't have any vegetables.
No vegetables. You know, and sometimes I'm like, you know, I said I'd never guilt trip my kid. I do that lightly, but you know, and I try to cook what he likes. But at the same time, you know, you really do have it pretty darn good. And just because we can't go to the local arcade every day doesn't mean you don't have it very well.
Some kids have never been to the local arcade.
Absolutely right.
Oh, yeah, I remember at one point taking a couple of my boys with me to take clothes and other supplies to a shelter and to divide them up and stuff. And I thought, well, maybe they would see by at least dragging the bags themselves that it's something that needs to be done.
Absolutely right. You know, each one teach one. And the best way to teach, I always believe in, is modeling it. Not that we have to feel like if we're not perfect, because none of us are, that we can't teach. There's so much we can just model for our children.
During times like vacation or summer, homeless kids can't rely on going off to school for a resource, for a place to be with peers. What happens during those kinds of times?
Well, I'll tell you, for example, I've really got an appreciation for why, as maddening as it is, snow days here in this country, especially, for example, in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, they were very averse to giving a snow day. And I was always, you know, like, what is this about? We have 6 inches just like they do in Montgomery County. I learned later that when they don't have school, that they don't have school lunches. That might be the only meal they get for the entire day. So while I'm sitting with my feet up, eating whatever I'm eating, bonbons or Cheetos or whatever, they're hungry. So the point, going back to your point about what happens, is I think society's learning more about homelessness and the importance of summer school programs, for example, even if the child did well in school, so they can get a meal. So that someone's got an eye on them when mom and or dad is trying to work, trying to find a job, trying to find housing, and isn't available to be that eye on the child. It's hugely important.
What about the little ones who are too young to be in school and they're homeless?
That's an outstanding point, and it's a scary point. Again, I think, you know, it depends on where you are, but I think one of the things we're trying to do is to become more sensitive to that need. And so there, you'll see that there's more daycare, state-sponsored daycare systems popping up, early childhood education intervention programs popping up for those same reasons. You hit on a point even below that. If you're a baby, it's difficult. There are programs, depending on where you are, for that, like the WIC program, Women with Infant Children, where they get baby food and milk formula to assist them with that. There are programs out there, but some of the difficulty can be trying to let people know who need those programs that they're there, and how to access them. On topic, off topic, it makes me just cry when I hear about, like, the story a couple of weeks ago in the news where a young lady who just had a baby put her baby into the river and killed the baby. Huh. And now there's a law in some jurisdictions that says you don't have to do that. You can take them to a hospital, to a place of worship, to a firehouse, anywhere where the responsible adult is going to find the child in a timely way, and you will not be prosecuted. And I'm like, if that woman had only known, maybe that child would be alive. It's hugely important that we don't just put programs in place, that we make sure the people who need them know they're there and know how to access them.
And so often those are the very people who are not in a school, they're not in a church or a synagogue, they're not reading a newspaper, they don't have a television or a radio. It's very hard to communicate all
these
things.
Absolutely right. So some of it becomes very grassroots. You know, I'm a very optimistic professional in person, so absolutely. And again, it can feel very daunting. At the same time, what I've seen is the more we understand that, the better we can address it. We can wring our hands, but I think that we know that, so we just act on it. And that's another reason why school is hugely important. Most homeless people who have children, because the law is that they have to be in school, they're at least in school. And so we use that, like you can't imagine. I mean, oftentimes there's, for example, mental health services that are provided in school because we know we can get the kid there. We can find them. And so that can be a huge resource. And those families often have younger children who are not in school, but the target is the child in school, and then we get to the family. Because if we have that child that's a member of the family, we can get to the parent or parents, and we can get to the other siblings who may be younger. So there really are ways. We just have to use them.
I'm thinking, for example, about high school kids who in many jurisdictions across the country have classes about child care or parenting or something connected with family living. Mm-hmm. Are there situations where those teenagers can help care for infants that are in homeless shelters?
Absolutely. And one of the greatest resources that we have at our child welfare agency is high school students who come and volunteer in our daycare center for art. We have two shelters for families. And high school students will come and help with daycare. They do everything. They do everything from stuffing envelopes to changing diapers to making sure that the books are sorted to reading to the children. So high school students can be an amazing resource. They have all the energy that we don't have as older people and more time, you know, so they don't tend to have a job. So they can be an amazing resource.
And I guess the community service requirement that's in many, many jurisdictions can be filled very easily by something like this.
Oh, I love it. I keep my eye out no matter where I am. When I hear either a parent or a family member, for other aunts and uncles saying it, or the child themselves, where am I going to do my service learning hours? I have a place for you. And I'll give
them
the name.
Step right this way.
Absolutely. Yes. Give them the name of our volunteer coordinator and get them plugged in. Helps both sides.
Okay. We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on homeless families and children.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Roxanne Dryden-Edwards about homeless families.
What kinds of personality changes do you see when a child's family becomes homeless?
You know, just like every other child in person, it's going to depend on the child. So it's a full gamut. I mean, some become expert survivors and, you know, brilliant at it and being able to find. We have ex-residents sometimes who come by, and they always seem to pop up at mealtime. And we're like, go on downstairs, get yourself a meal, and stop by the pantry and get yourself some cans of food. You know, the survival skills can become acutely honed, and that, again, can be a strength. There's that, and there's everything else. There's depression, irritability, anxiety, anger. They can become withdrawn. They can regress, I think is an important word, especially for children. I mean, adults do it too, but it's harder to tell sometimes with us. They tend to regress means they tend to go back to an earlier stage of development. So, for example, a teenager may start bedwetting or get more clingy, you know, a latency age, which is like 6 to 11 or 12 years old child may get more clingy to adults. So they may go backwards to an earlier stage of development. So it really runs the gamut. The other point I guess I want to make is that besides being dependent on who they are just in terms of their makeup, it also can be linked to why they're homeless. So, for example, the family who becomes homeless because there's a death in the family, the child might be more of a grieving child. Or a child whose family is homeless is because they had to run from the other parent who was committing domestic violence, maybe going through post-traumatic issues, anxiety, more anxiety, nightmares, flashbacks, those kind of things. So some of it can depend on what caused the homelessness.
Do sometimes kids who find themselves in this situation think like a kid going through a divorce that, well, it might have been partially their fault?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially the young kids, but I've seen it with the older residents as well. And again, as the reason I say that about the younger residents is because that tends to be how they're made up psychologically. They're in a stage of everything revolves around me. We call it egocentric. It's normal. You know, everything's about me, so then therefore I cause everything. So if I can cause good things, I can also cause bad things. Like if they didn't have to take care of me, we wouldn't be homeless. Or if I was just a good boy, a better girl, then mommy and daddy wouldn't be fighting. Absolutely. But the teenagers go through it sometimes as well. It must be about me.
Would you clarify something, please, because I don't really know a whole lot about what goes on in a homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. But if a family comes there to stay, obviously they sleep there overnight. What happens in the morning?
It depends on the homeless shelter. For example, with us, we have them linked to a caseworker, one of our own, who is, you know, their job is to work with that family and figure out what do you need to change this situation. Do you need job training? Do you need to learn how to write a resume, fill an application? How do we plug you into some places where you would fit for a job? What do we need to do to get you housing that you can afford and a place you can afford, food and clothing? So a lot of that work goes on during the day at our place. And part of that is probably because we're family-oriented. Mm-hmm. Children go to school if they're of age. If they're not of age, they can go to our daycare center or they stay with their parent, depending on the child and what the parent is doing. Other homeless shelters, especially those for adults, what they're trying to push while they have those supports there is you need to be out doing something to change your situation. So oftentimes they close during the day. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to sleep there, so you're safe and warm and cared for and you get a meal. Then in the morning, you do need to go out and do what you need to do, but you're welcome back in the evening. The other piece, I don't want to paint it as, you know, this pie in the sky thing, because oftentimes the reason they close is just purely economic. They don't have the money to be able to staff it and provide services and food in order to keep it open. So they, you know, they target it for what they can and where the most need is, which is night. So it depends.
Dr. Dryden Edwards, what other suggestions would you have for how parents could help their children be more sensitive to a homeless classmate situation?
I believe in mantras, things to remember. And one mantra I would advise would be put yourself in that person's shoes. Think about what you would feel like if you were homeless or your mommy were homeless or you didn't have enough food and you didn't know where your next meal was coming from. Be sensitive and just think about how you would feel in that situation. And it puts a whole new light on blaming the victim, so to speak, and not wanting to get involved.
And I guess that means also that adults, particularly teachers, should be aware for the kinds of changes that you were talking about, behavioral changes, personality changes, because it's possible that this child has recently become homeless or
absolutely
that kind of thing is going on.
Absolutely. There's a psychiatrist from Yale, Dr. James Comer, who writes extensively about mental health in schools and interacting between mental health and educators. And I think one of the best take-home points for our educators is understand or get help to understand what might be behind the behavior. And it can feel daunting, I can imagine, if you have, like where we are here, 30 kids in the classroom to say, do something else. It's like, yeah, right. I've seen it make their jobs easier. It doesn't make sense, and you won't have good outcome if you treat or address someone who's acting out because they're grieving versus someone who's acting out because they learned that at home, for example. So get consultation with the counselor of your school if you need to understand what's going on behind the behavior.
Which brings us to an important topic that we always like to leave our listeners with, and that is resources.
Mm-hmm.
So you started that beautifully. Are there any other resources that you would suggest for our listeners who want to research some of these issues further?
Absolutely. I think a great website, and yes, this is a plug, but I think it'll also help our listeners out there. The website of the National Center for Children and Families, which is a child welfare agency and runs two homeless shelters, the website there will tell you things to understand about homeless individuals, children especially, how you can get involved to help. Even if you're not located in this area, there are things you can get involved in here, but it also will be a springboard for what you can do in your own community. The website there is www.nccf, like Frank, dash like a hyphen sign, cares.org.
Dr. Roxanne Dryden Edwards, you certainly have shown us a profile of how we can care much more and how we can actually make a difference. So thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll free at 1-800-791-8573. with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 220. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Hospital for Sick Children Foundation in Washington, D.C. Our sound engineer is Andrea Tokich. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.